Welcome to another episode of Adam's Corner, and on this episode, I am very fortunate to have Mr. Guy Aoki, who was very instrumental in American Top 40. He actually worked with Casey Kasem himself during the 1980s. He's got lots of interesting stories. I don't want to steal his thunder, but I just wanted to give him a nice intro here. I just feel so honored to have somebody who is so closely connected to Casey Kasem on my show. That's just a real honor, and we had Pete Battistini on the last episode, so I thought it would be great to have a part two, as it were, celebrating Casey's American Top 40, which continues on, unfortunately without Casey, but Casey was the first and in many people's memories the greatest host of American Top 40, especially those of us who grew up in a certain era. But you just have such fascinating stories, and I'm not going to yammer on here. I'm going to let you get started and just tell us. I guess the first question I had was, what was your first AT40 exposure? When did you first connect with the show? And you and I have talked about this before the recording started, but you were a music fan, and you can tell us a little bit about that as well and how that tied into your first exposure of American Top 40.
Well, I grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, which is on the big island of Hawaii with all the active volcanoes. It was about 25,000 people back then. And I remember maybe 73, 74, when we'd be driving from, long distance from our house to another lot we had, the radio would be on, and I would hear Casey in the background. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I didn't pay attention to music closely until about the middle of 74 when I went through adolescence. And it's a kind of a strange thing, but I began to get melancholy about the good old days. I had a very rough time transitioning from sixth grade, which is elementary school for us back then, to intermediate school in seventh grade. You go from being the king of the school to being the bottom of the barrel, and people pick on you and all that. And I would have this really difficult time just trying to get home on the bus, because there were two loads. The first load, they got to, as soon as the school bell rings, get on the bus, go home, great. And we have to wait 45 minutes for the bus to make all of its drop-offs and come back to us. And in the meantime, I get picked on for being Japanese. My family's been in Hawaii since 1890-something, so we're as American as you can possibly be. But I got all these racial slurs thrown at me, so I had a really hard time. Yeah. And so I would hear these old songs on the radio, and they would really make me remember when I was younger, and I could just remember how I felt, the innocence I felt, where I was. And I felt sad that I knew nothing about these artists. I knew nothing about the songs. And so I finally decided, okay, I'm going to commit to sitting down and listening to American Top 40, all 3 hours, which became four later on. And I wrote down number 40 through number one, how much a song went up from last week, how much it went down, where did it peak, and any kind of trivia that Casey Kasem offered. And I think it was my way of not only appreciating the music that I like hearing on the radio then in January of 75, but also to be able to learn what I missed, because Casey would sometimes talk about older stuff. So that's what it was for me. And so whether I had a bad week or I had a good week at school, Saturday night from 6 to 9, I was in heaven. I got to see how all my favorite songs were doing nationwide, and see how much was going up and all that stuff. So that's what it meant to me initially. Yeah,
and you're the town you grew up in. I think I remember reading in Pete Battistini's book that it was quite small. There were like 25,000. It was a town. Yeah. It was just not a large population. So, and you were kind of amazed that they actually had. You were thinking, how did they get this this countdown here?
I thought Casey Kasem lived somewhere in Hilo, Hawaii. And I went, how did they find this guy? He's like such a mailing quality guy. I showed you. Hey, I was in the seventh grade. My brain wasn't properly formed yet. So I thought, at the end, he says, tape the show in Hollywood. Huh. Maybe he lives in Los Angeles. Okay, I kind of eventually put it together.
Yes.
I thought he was a local DJ. And yeah, it took a while for me to figure it out.
Well, you got there. That's what matters.
I got there. Eventually, I got there. Yeah.
Yeah. We've ascertained you were, like I said, a huge music fan also, and you had a, I guess, a pretty decent record collection by the time you started listening to American Top 40, decent size. I mean, back then, we didn't have a lot of disposable income when we're in, at that age. It's kind of tough to have a huge collection, but you find ways, as I did.
Well, I actually started buying vinyl. I started buying singles in August of 75, just before I got into the eighth grade. And then I started buying albums in January of 76. So I wasn't buying records when I started listening to 1840. You
Oh,
get
that's
it.
okay. That's interesting. Yeah, that's funny you mentioned that because I actually bought my first 45 in August of 75 as well. I turned 5 and I had, my dad would he, my dad was a record collector. He had when he passed, he had about 100,000 records in his collection. He had bought them since he was 4 years old up until he literally months before he passed at the age of 77. And I wound up inheriting his entire collection, which was quite sizable. It was a lot to sort through, but I would trail him to record stores, and I would tell him what I wanted, and he would get it for me basically. So that's how I wound up buying my first record, and it was The Hustle by Van McCoy. That was the first 45 that I ever bought.
Great record, great record.
Yes. Still good if you ask me. So you anyway, things move on. Moving along to the mid 70s, and then into the you graduate high school, going on to college, and then you got the idea to send some questions in, and that's an interesting story too. So I thought I'd let you tell us about that.
Yeah, so fall of 1980, I went to Occidental College in Los Angeles. Barack Obama was there. I didn't know it at the time. He was 1 year older than me. And I stayed there until ending of 81. And then I went to Honolulu for college in between, University of Hawaii at Manoa. And I'll catch the bus every Saturday, go and get my comic books and get my records. And I don't know if you remember, there was a GEM, GEM department store. It's like Sears and Penney's, and they all had their own little music department. So you walk in, and the first thing that you're faced with is the cutout bins. These are albums that they manufactured too much of, didn't sell enough, and so they reduced them to 99 cents, $1.99. So I went through them, and I found this album by The First Class, and I turned it over, and I had no idea what First Class was. I turned it over, and it had little liner notes. It said, "Features the beautiful singing voice of Tony Burrows, who sang with White Plains and Flower Power Man." I went, "Wait, wait, wait, wait." He sang, see, because by this point, I had become such a fan of chart positions and all that stuff. I bought the Joe Whitburn book, which everybody bought. This
Oh,
Joe
yes.
Whitburn book tells you every single that ever made the Hot 100 from 1955 on. And so you could look up and see your favorite song. Oh, wow, it went to that. What? It stopped at 37. Are you kidding? Why? All that kind of stuff. So by that point, I've been also reading a lot of pop music encyclopedias. And one encyclopedia gave Tony Burrows credit for singing with three groups. Another one gave credit for him for singing with three groups, but it included a fourth group. So I put the two together. I knew, oh, he sang with four groups. Wow, it's amazing. So when I went back to my dorm, I looked up First Class, and yeah, Beach Baby went to number four. Whoa, this guy was in five different groups. He sang lead with five different groups. So I did my research, and I said, yeah, that's the record, by far the record. So I was a fan of America's Top 10, which is Casey's TV show. And if you get your trivia question read, you get like a hot air popcorn machine. So I said, man, it'll be so cool to see my popcorn machine in the corner of my dorm room right there. Oh, that'll be so cool. So I sent the information in, and I'd watch every Saturday afternoon, and they wouldn't use it. And I was kind of indignant, like, what? How can you not use this? This is a really, really good piece of information. So life went on, and so I was going to return to Oxy Occidental College in the fall of 83. And about a month before I left, I said, send it to American Top 40. So I wrote all this stuff and I said, look, you sang lead with Edison Lighthouse, Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes, My Baby Loves Lovin' with White Plains, United We Stand, Divided We Fall by the Brotherhood of Man, Pipkins, Give Me That Ding, and Beach Baby by First Class. So I listened every Sunday before I went off to brunch and didn't use it. So the one time I said to myself, okay, do not listen to the show because you got to do finals. And the 4 hours you're going to take to listen to the show is better spent on studying for finals. So I go down to the cafeteria. And this Guy Staples, he goes, Guy, where you from again? You're from Hilo, right? Yeah. Yeah, Casey Kasem was just talking about you. What? Yeah, something about this guy who holds the record for singing lead vocals with the most groups. And it was five? What? And his name is Tony Burrows. What? And he released solo singles, but the highest he got was number 87 with the song called Melanie Makes Me Smile. What? I was like, when did you hear this? He goes, just now, before I came down to brunch. I was like, I don't believe it. I missed my own trivia question. Ugh. So after finals was over, went back to Hilo, and I tracked down the radio station that still aired 1840, and they said, well, we don't have the record anymore. So, but Burger King is our sponsor, and so we gave it to them. So I went over and I borrowed it and I made a record. So I got to hear it. The interesting thing about this is timing was essential because I was in my procrastination mode. So this aired in December of 83. I didn't write a thank you note until March of 84. That's how procrastinated. And I said, oh, it was so great to hear my name on the radio. My friends are all excited to hear my name. Blah, 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 blah. And so I was thinking about, oh, wait, summer's coming in June. So, P.S., do you need a statistician or something? If you do, can you please send me an application form? So I was in a library one day and I was studying as always. That was my new home. And I called in for messages and the dorm person said, oh yeah, Don Bustani called. I went, oh shit, Don Bustani. Oh my God. Oh shit. Oh crap. Okay, get your act together. Come on, get your act together. Okay. So I call him back. And he said, we thought you were still in Hawaii. Because remember, my trivia question was mail from Hawaii. My thank you note was mail from LA. So he goes, we're really impressed with what you know about pop music. And you asked if we have an opening. And actually, we are going to have one because Kristen is going to go into publishing and book publishing. And so we're looking for a production assistant. And, we usually have an interview, but we can forego that segment. You can start tomorrow if you want.
Wow.
I was like,
Wow.
whoa, what? I said, but the only thing is you need a car. You're going to need a car to do errands like delivering scripts to Casey or finding a record that we need to use for the show. So, you talk to your parents about it, okay? So my parents had always told me, look, we can't afford to get you a car college. You just take the bus. Oh, yeah, I understand. So I told them what the situation was. And my mom goes, we'll get you a car. So I got to start late April. Oh God, it's like, oh my goodness, we're talking 40 years ago.
It's unbelievable.
This weekend, I started, I think it was April 27th or 28th or something, 1984. So we're coming
Wow.
up on the 40th anniversary this week or this
What are the
Saturday.
odds? What are the
What a job!
odds? That's
Adam is
amazing.
psychic. Adam is psychic. Hey, I think I'll. I haven't emailed Guy for 3.5 years. I think I'll just kind of ask him if he wants to do a podcast. Hey,
This is fantastic.
but here's the funny thing. See, if I had sent my trivia question to American Top 40 in 82, they would have used it, they would have thanked me, and that would have been it. I wouldn't ask for a job. I was in Hawaii. And even if they aired it right after I wrote it, just before I left Hawaii to go back to Los Angeles, and I wrote a thank you note, away from Hawaii. I wouldn't ask for a job. So it's just timing. It's timing. It's just amazing. And then the funny thing too is that, I didn't have to come back to Occidental College. I mean, I remember having all of these long discussions with my counselors saying, what do I do? I mean, Oxy was like, people are nice, but I couldn't really get to know them. They weren't very deep. Just, and Hawaii, this is not really a great college. This is like, I went from making straight B's to straight A's. It wasn't that hard. And so I could have gone to UC Irvine, where I was accepted. That's, Southern California. I could have gone to Whitman College in Washington State. I could have gone to Willamette in Oregon because they all accepted me. And but my counselor said, you could, but there will be a part of you that would always wonder what could have happened if you had not gone back to Occidental. And so we both agreed. It's like, you know what? You started with Oxy, you're kind of stuck with Oxy. Because I had some bad experiences at Oxy, really bad experiences. And in fact, it was a strange thing. There was a point when I was in Honolulu at college, and I said, maybe I won't go back to LA. Maybe I'll just stay here, get a job, settle down, get married. And soon after that, I had this dream. I was back at Occidental, outside of their white pillar Coliseum-looking buildings. And I felt this profound sadness. Like I could almost reach it, but I couldn't touch it. And I said, wait a minute, you mean I'm never going to go back there? I'm never going to get to try again and make it better? Because I had football players screaming at night just to wake me up because I had the audacity to ask someone, like, okay, you guys keep it down because I have a 9 o'clock class tomorrow or whatever it was. And so they decided, well, we don't like this uppity guy, this uppity Japanese guy telling us what to do. So these white guys, they would like throw mustard bottles at my door. They tore a hollow tile brick at my door. I mean, it was
Jeez.
awful, awful. And I complained to the head of residency, and he said, I'll never forget the quote. We can't do anything about these boys, guy, because they come from good families who donate money to the school, unquote. So that was like the finger showing me the finger, slap in the face. So that's what I had to consider. Do I really want to go back to Occidental? And I needed to make it better. I needed to make a better memory of my time. So I went back to Oxy. If I had not gone back to Oxy, yeah, I could have written my letter from UC Irvine if I went to UC Irvine. But you know how long the bus would have taken to get me from another county, Orange County, up to LA County? I don't know if they would have tolerated me taking that long. Yeah, and I mean, when would I have time to be a student? It would take taking three and a half hours probably to go one way. It took me 1.5 hours just to go from Oxy to 1840 as it was in Los Angeles. Anyway, that's the backdrop.
Well, that's a very interesting story. It's very interesting, and I can identify how tough that must have been. That just sounds horrible, and I have personally endured experiences like that too. So I,
Oh,
you
I'm
know
sorry.
that, yeah. So I can identify. I have been there in very similar situations. So hearing you say that kind of brought it back to me a little bit. But yes, and now you had moved from your hometown, you said, to LA, somewhere in there. What was the reason that you actually did move to LA by the time I might have missed something there, or maybe you said it and I overheard it,
That's okay. Because I mean the sense in high school was that UH Manoa was an okay school, but if you really want to get ahead, if you really want to go to a good school, they're all on the
or
mainland. So I applied to like four different places on the mainland, the
Oh,
college.
okay, that's a
And
right.
I applied to UH Manoa as a backup. If they all rejected me, okay, I'll go to Manoa, I'll go to Honolulu. So that's why I decided to go to Occidental.
Okay, so that's how it happened. Okay, yeah, that all makes sense. But yeah, that's a good question about the Tony Burrows, because I've always been fascinated by that as well. So we're similar on that one. That's and yeah, because I'm a fan of I know there was a CD that they actually compiled the CD of all the It was like the magical voice of Tony Burrows or something in the early 90s.
I help with that. I help with that.
Oh, did you? Wow.
But this is, I don't want to go off tangent too much, but you see,
Wow.
in the era of the CD, when they were reissuing so many greatest hits
Yes.
compilation artists, I wrote a want list to Rhino Records. I wrote, you should do this, you should do this, do that. And the guy wrote back, Stewart, what was his name? Something Stewart. And he would say why he called me up and he said every single one, he told me why no, it wouldn't work. And one of it was Tony Burrows.
Oh.
And I also gave it to Varese Vintage, which also
Yes.
was a smaller Rhino, right?
Yes.
And the guy rejected it too. And then so can you imagine how I feel when I get a phone call in 97 or something, whenever that thing came out, I think it came out in 96. Okay, so before 96, I got a call from someone saying he's doing the liner notes for a Tony Burrows compilation, and the head of Varese Vintage said I should talk to you because you knew stuff. And I went, what the f, this was my idea. How many years? I said, oh. But he was a nice guy. He was a nice guy. And to his credit, he knew some records that Tony did. I had no idea. So it had to go to somebody. His name is Gordon Pagoda, by the way. Gordon Pagoda.
Oh,
If it
okay.
had to go to somebody else to do a compilation, he knew more records than Tony did than I did. Not all,
Yeah.
but some. This crucial song that he knew that I did not know, which should have been a top five hit. It's called "Have You Had a Little." Have you had a little bit of happiness lately?
Oh,
By Domino. Do you know that? Oh, that's on the Tony Burrows great
yes, it is.
compilation.
Yes, it's on
That
there.
song was so catchy, it should have been a top five hit. I did
I
not know
agree.
about it. Gordon knew it. Good for you, Gordon.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And it's just a couple of weeks ago, you mentioned talking about Varese Vintage, because a couple of weeks ago I had Barry Scott on, who's the host of the Lost 45s. And I think he had interviewed Casey at some point for his show. But anyway, he was instrumental in doing a series of CDs. Barry Scott Presents the Lost 45s, and it was basically songs that had never been released commercially on CD. And he did two volumes, and he said after two volumes, it was kind of what you were saying. They said, well, we don't want to go to the trouble to find out who legally owns the rights. It's just too much trouble. So, and he said, I was hoping to do a whole series of those. And he said, it just, they didn't. So, he did two volumes, which are really good, the ones he did. So, but it's a shame those things. Now, did you have any input in the, and I know we are getting off topic a little bit, but I'm just curious about the super hits of the 70s series that Rhino did. Have a Nice Day, Super Hits of the 70s, because I think there were like 25 volumes of those. I didn't know if you had any input with those or not.
No. They already had Paul Grind, so Paul Grind was going to do the whole series. So Paul Grind, who's a friend, he's a nice guy, and he worked at American Top 40 in the mid 70s for a couple of years.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I knew that. Yeah.
And of course, he wrote the chart beat column for Billboard, analyzing it week by week in the 80s. So he's a very nice guy.
That was a great series of CDs they put out, and then there was a companion series that covered the early 80s, that kind of a transitional, and I can't remember, there were only five volumes of that. I can't remember the name of the series, but anyway, good stuff. So yeah. So moving along, as it were. So you began your job as a production assistant, and I was going to get you to tell us a little bit about, what that was like when you first walked into this studio and that experience, which had to be just amazing.
Well, see, here's the thing. I'm sure most people felt the same way. When we listened to American Top 40, we assumed KC just went into the studio, played the records live, and said whatever came off the top of his head. Well, maybe he had some notes. I didn't realize until I went to my first recording studio, that KC made mistake after mistake after mistake. He would go to one sentence and a half, and then he had to screw it up. He had to start over it. And so the editors, the engineers would have to, we were doing reel-to-reel tape back then. We would have to mark on the script, okay, take three, take four, take five. So when the whole show was over, they would have to go reel-to-reel and with a blade and sticky tape, they would have to go, okay, pass, take one, take two, take three. I saw one where he did 21 takes on the same place. So they have to go through 21, three, four, five, six, okay, take 21, okay. Get rid of that, throw that out. All right, put it back on the master tape. Okay, continue on to the next mistake. And then we go into the studio and then we'd add the records and mix the voice track without any mistakes. with the actual records. And I got to do that from early 86 to 88. I got to decide how much of a song we would play, because we had to reach 47 minutes and 45 seconds, meaning the other 12 minutes and 15 seconds was ads that the local station would air. So we had to come 47, 45 seconds on the dot. And so sometimes Casey talked too long. We had to cut the records. We had to like come out of the records a lot sooner than we should. Sometimes there weren't that many long stories in an hour. So we would have to play album version, album version, album version, album version. And we wouldn't put the music under Casey's talk, introducing it. We'd have to start it cold. So all these tricks we had to learn, but I got to do that. It was very, very creative. And so, you know, a lot of the stuff that people are still hearing now, about the first 2 hours, I pretty much mixed it with an engineer. And then Matt Wilson, the associate producer, would come in and he would finish it off. And sometimes he wouldn't come back. He wouldn't come back from dinner. So I would just do the whole show myself.
Yeah. And that was a weekly grind too. So it's, you know, you guys had a well-oiled machine there. And so I'm sure it was, you know, a tight ship you were running. I mean, you're certainly on deadlines and all of that sort of thing. And so I can imagine what a time crunch that might've been at times when, you know, if something happened that was unexpected and you were thrown an extra cog in the wheel, I guess you would say.
So we got to read the letters, all the long distance dedication requests. And at some point, Don Bastani, our producer, would say, you know what, can you guys help the writers out? Can you guys put grades on them? And then, you know, give it to us. And the thing that really made me mad was every time I put an A letter, I said, this is an A, they wouldn't use it. And the letters I put C minus, they would use it. I'm like, oh, God, you guys got no taste at all. I was not a fan of LDDs, especially with, you know, Don had an acronym for everything. So long distance dedication, he would call it LDD. And, you know, they started running them twice a show. So I just thought, get on with the countdown, man. I don't want to hear these sappy, oh, Casey, she's the best girl I ever met in my life. And we got together Against All Odds. And, oh, no, I know where this is going. So will you please play Against All Odds by Phil Collins? Oh, no. Or, oh, Casey, she's such an inspiration. Oh, okay, I know where this is going. So will you please play You're the Inspiration by Chicago? Oh, no.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I know. I can imagine a little bit of that goes a long way, especially when you're working with it week after week after week. So, yeah.
When you're reading it. Oh,
oh 80, yeah.
I would say 80% of our letters were long distance dedications. The other ones were like, oh, I love the show, or can I get an autograph, or trivia questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, most of it was they wanted to get the dedication on the air.
Yeah, and you don't think about how the person who actually had to sit there and read the long distance dedications, all of the ones that didn't get on the air because somebody had to read them and sift through them, as it were, and try to figure out which one. So that's a tall order when you think about it. So.
Anyway,
sounds like you're having PTSD. I'm bringing up
PTSD. My C minus is getting on the air, and my A letter is going in the trash bin. How dare you!
Oh my goodness, yeah, that's something you don't consider, the person who had to actually do the reading, but it has to be done. I mean, you know, because otherwise you can't find the material that is acceptable for the LDDs, as it were. So, I think eventually you were fired and then hired back. That's an interesting story too. Well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. I guess what I wanted to ask too was what it was like the first time you actually met Casey. I guess that's, yeah, because I'm skipping way ahead of that.
That's a great question, because I'd worked in the offices for, I don't know, maybe a week and a half. Mm-hmm. And then Don said, hey, it's time to meet Casey. You know, when you catch the bus, don't come to our production offices here. Go straight to the studio, which is like three blocks down. So I remember getting off the bus, and before I crossed the street, I said to myself, "Guy, your life is about to change forever." And sure, of course it did. You know, so I walked into this office room, and they said, "Oh, over there." So I opened this door, and I hear Casey Kasem talking and repeating his lines over and over again. know, what is this? Is someone rewinding tape? What is it? There were like four doors. Which door do I open? So, well, this one, I guess. Open the door. There's Matt Wilson. Hey, guy, come in. He's waving me in. I walk in, and to the right, I see this glass booth, and there's Casey Kasem. So, you know, so we sit. You can picture like the Enterprise, you know, Star Trek, the Enterprise. If you're looking at outer space, Casey Kasem's booth is outer space, and all the other people, like Captain Kirk and Uhura and all the other people, are behind him. We're all production assistants and producers going over the script to make sure he doesn't make a mistake. So that's how it looked, okay? And during the first break, I guess after one of the hours ended, Matt goes, he makes a finger like, "Hey, come, follow me." So we go into the booth, and he goes, "Hey, Casey, I just want you to introduce you to a new production assistant. He just joined us. His name is Guy Oki." And he says, "Oh, hi, Guy." And I said, "Yeah, well, you know, I've listened to your show since 1975. So, well, welcome aboard, Guy." And shook hands. I told this to my friends, and one of my friends goes, "Welcome aboard! Welcome aboard! Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!" They're so excited. Yeah. I will tell you something really funny, because I was in my last year in college, and so many people wanted autographs from Casey that it was a ritual. Every when we had a break, we would bring in his mail, if anything he needed to see, or mostly just autographs. You know, if people sent a really nice letter, we said, "Let's send him an autograph." And I would get all these requests from my friends to autographs. And at one point, he looked at me very seriously. He wasn't joking. He goes, "I've never met someone who had so many friends before. I should hold a dance and so I can meet all of them." And I was laughing, but I'm looking at him. He's not laughing. He's serious. Like, how can you have so many friends who want my autograph? In fact, a few months ago, Dave Kim, he is now the Secretary of Transportation for the state of California. On Facebook, he posted his autograph picture of Casey Kasem that I got him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
That's
he became a
great.
bigwig, but hey, we're all Casey fans.
That's right. That we are. All right, so I guess the next thing that happened after you were employed as a production assistant, I guess the next thing on your trajectory was that you were fired and hired back, which is an interesting story, I think, unto itself. And I thought I would let you relate that one as well.
Well, see, Don Bastani, the man who hired me, and he was the original producer of the show, and he edited the copy of the two writers he had. He said that he didn't usually keep production assistants around long. But by the time it gets to be about a year, they start to get lazy and lose inspiration and stuff. But he said, "You know, you've been really helpful to the writers because you know so much about music and trivia. So we've kept you along probably longer than anybody. But you know, I'm going to have to kind of give you a gentle push out of the nest, you know. So I just want to give you notice that I have to let you go." Okay. So I wrote letters out to different people. I wrote to a recording studio and all that kind of stuff. And about, I don't know how many days it was. Was it 12 days later? Don calls me and he says, "Have you found anything yet?" I goes, "No." He goes, "Well, you know, I got something you may be interested in. As you know, Jay Goldsworthy, he's the author of the American Top 40 annual, the one and only annual they did for 1978. He had been working on this computer project where he's inputting every single individual who ever made the top 40, either as part of a group or solo. And he said, you know, he needs some help with that. Would you like to help?" I said, "Sure." So he hired me back. And it's really funny. Matt Wilson was such a nice guy. We had so many laughs.
I
There you
have
go. You
that
joined the annual to speak. You
annual.
nerd. You nerd.
Exactly. Anyway, I couldn't resist. Keep going. Sorry.
Don't mind me. I'm just. But Matt was such a. He was such a great guy, and we had so much fun together. And where was I going with this?
Well, we were talking about how,
So he would have parties at his house every so often. I remember, like, he took me around to introduce me to his friends, and he had his hand on my shoulder, and he goes, "This is the only man Don Bastani ever fired and then hired back again." He would start laughing, and he would nod like, "Hey, must be pretty good, huh? Why do you think he hired him back?" And I said, "Really?" No one ever came back. He goes, oh no, if Don fired you, you were gone. And he was laughing. I said, that could be a trivia question. Who's the only person? So we're laughing. But yeah, so I was the only guy who ever got hired back.
That's quite a distinction. I mean,
Hey, what
you've got to hand it to yourself for
can
that
I say?
one.
What can I say? And
Yeah.
the nice thing is, so that was like, you know, what I was let go in August of 86. No, August of 85. And I got hired back in August of 85. And then in early 86 is when he asked me to help to mix the shows with the engineers. So he gave me these opportunities to grow beyond just being a production assistant who just retyped everyone's scripts, you know. And it got to the point where I would get Daryl Morton's draft and Meryl Schindler's drafts, and I would see. It's so funny that they did it on selected twos or selected typewriters. You know, if they had computers, none of this would have happened. But I learned how to write by seeing the editing that went on from the first draft to Don's draft and giving it to me and saying, okay, type it on cue cards for Casey to read. I saw what was extraneous to a story. So when Daryl would do a story on Bruce Springsteen, I would say, no, Don's going to cut that out. So I would, you know, I because Daryl would, they would give me their scripts on 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper, and they would do their own scribbles, pencil or pen, and here, guy, retype this. Really funny. They got to retype their own mistakes. So I would retype it, and as I retyped it, I would realize, no, that's extraneous. You got to put more on that point. You made a point. You haven't backed up that point. Sure enough, I give it to Don. I get it back from Don. Yeah, he writes more, fleshing out certain things and cutting out extraneous things. So after a while, I said, you know, I think I know how to write radio shows. And it's not something I ever considered as a job. I didn't know it was a job. I thought it was, you know, Casey goes into the studio and just talks up the top of his head. And so when Meryl Schindler was going to leave, ending of 85 or 86, Don Bastani put out a call for nationwide call for anybody. We're looking for a replacement writer. And he said, it's open to everybody on the staff, everybody. And in fact, to be fair, we are not going to look at the name of the person until we get to the top five. I made the top five. You know, I made it, but I knew I was not going to get it because I'm just a production assistant. You know, it's like people know you, your reputation is how they met you. Guy's a PA, guy's an intern, guy's a. You know. And I, of course, I didn't get it. And the guy who got it, they had to rewrite him so many times. It's like, why did you even hire him? I mean, I know how to write this because I know what was taken out before the final draft. Nothing against him. He was a nice guy. You know, we used to joke a lot. Nice guy, funny guy. But anyway, so I realized I had to go elsewhere to get appreciated. So I started sending out resumes. And I eventually got my job at Dick Clark Productions, you know, where, not to get ahead of myself, but just to finish the thought that I ended up writing syndicated radio shows with Dick Clark from January 1989 through December of 2005. So that's almost 17 years. Anyway, back to you.
That's quite a
Back to you, Adam. Back to you, Adam.
that's quite a that, I mean, that's a nice run for sure. But yeah, before we went any farther, though, I have to talk about this, I guess, is the infamous Casey Kasem tape, the dead dog tape, because you were there. You were one of the
I
few
was
people.
there. I was in the. You tell, or should I tell a story? You want
No.
to? I'm talking too much. People are tuning off now because they're sick of my voice. You should tell the story.
No. It's you. Well, you were there. I was not. I mean, and
Okay.
these are the things that I love. I love these stories. These are awesome.
Okay. Okay. So
So yeah.
Casey was reading a long distance dedication. It was about a man. I think it was a man. Of somebody, could have been a female, whose dog died. The dog was named Shannon. No. The dog was named Snuggles.
That's right.
Snuggles. How could I forget? Poor Snuggles.
The record is Shannon.
The dedication, you know, goes like, you know, Casey is like a death in the family. No. And what happened was Casey had to come out of Dare Me by the Pointer Sisters, which was this kind of upbeat, kind of dance pop 80s. And then he had to make a transition from this upbeat. That's the Pointer Sisters, number 25 with Dare Me. And now we're up to our long distance dedication. And it's about, and he couldn't make the transition from upbeat to sad. And he tried so many times, and he would get for, and the edited, there's an edited version of his rant on YouTube. And it is really edited because he tried, I think on the what's out there, he tried maybe once or twice before he really blew his stack. I'm telling you, he tried like at least seven times. He tried over and over and over again. And something was bugging him. He just stopped, and then he finally got past a certain point in the script. I'm like, okay, good, now we're going there. And then he started tearing his tirade because he realized why he was screwing up so bad. He goes, "You know, I keep telling them over and over again, do not give me a goddamn up-tempo record when you're gonna go into a death dedication." And so I was thinking, "Oh, come on, Casey, look, just be professional. Just finish the script. Come on." But
Right.
no, he was on a roll. No. Threw his glasses down the podium. He came out of the booth, and the phone was ringing. "Is that Don? Is that Don on the phone?" And Daryl Morey goes, "No, it's TR, Tom Rounds, the executive producer."
Yeah.
That's when he goes, "You know, I want someone to use their effing brain to not come out of an effing up-tempo record and expect me to go into a story about a dog dying. You know, I do this all the time. I don't know why they do this to me. They do this to me all the time." So anyway. If you need to, and I'm sure I just gave you a great tease. If you haven't heard it before, it's on YouTube. So that's how that happened. That's how that happened.
Yeah, you and you that's amazing because like I said, it's one of those it's one of those legendary things that people have heard the world over, and you were there, so you were there
So,
for history.
people have the audio. They can listen to the audio. I have the video in my mind.
Right,
You got
yeah.
to download my brain to see the video, but I have the video in my mind of how that happened. But you
Yeah.
know, but here's the thing. Casey, he knew Don Bastani since he got out of when Don was out of college back in the
Yeah.
early 70s. And so they had a close relationship. At the same time, Don was a real perfectionist in the studio to the
Yeah.
point where he would ask Casey to redo stuff over and over again. Even when the rest of us couldn't hear any difference. And I look at Casey and Don would say, "Well, that was great, Casey. Let's do it again. Wait a minute. If it's great, why am I doing it again?" And there was this look of distrust from Casey to Don, like, "What are you trying? Why are you making me do it again?" So
Yeah.
there was a lot of, at that point in 85, this was taped in 85, the dedication.
Yes.
There was a lot of distrust, and Casey would get really mad. He would leave the studio in a huff, and he wouldn't come back for 20 minutes. It happened over and over again. But I think to defend Casey, I think what it was he was a very frustrated actor. In fact, when I was there in probably the first year, People Magazine did a story on him, and they talked to his friends and they said, "Casey believes he's going to be a movie star, and no one can talk him out of it. He will not hear anything to the contrary. Radio's fine for now, but he really wants to be an actor." So I think when things went bad, I think the frustrated actor in him came out and he overacted. He went
Yeah.
over the top. That's what happened. So that's the context I want to give. Because Casey was, I hope we get to it later on, but Casey was just an amazing human being.
Yeah,
You know?
we're certainly getting to that
Okay,
point
I'll get
for
to it
sure.
later. But Casey was an amazing human being. So I
Yes.
just want people to know that. Yes, he had a temper tantrum. Yes, you can laugh at the Snuggles dedication all you want. I just want you to know the bottom line is I love Casey Kasem, and he was just a good, decent man. Anyway, go ahead.
No, we all have moments like that. I mean, that's just human nature. And so you can't really judge a person's character just by one moment of anger. I mean, I've certainly had them, and I consider myself to be a fairly decent guy, but I've had moments when something just hit me wrong, so it's
I'll tell you something. I'll tell you something real fast. You know, the interesting thing is when you go to, I mean, several people have this on YouTube, but
Yeah.
the one I went to years ago about his rant. And now, you know, as much as I do, people, when they're on the internet, they can be as cynical and backbiting and insulting as they want, because no one knows who they are. They can
Yes.
say whatever they want. They have a code name. They don't have Guy Aoki on. They don't. I expected to see a lot of people say, you know what? I didn't know Casey was this. I can never listen to his show again. What a hypocrite. I was bracing for that. I went pages and pages and pages. Everybody supported Casey. Not
Wow.
one person said, oh my God, I can't believe he did that. They all said, well, I'd be mad too. I was talking to Paul Greiner about this because at one of our reunions of American Top 40 staffers, we had one. We had two back to back after Casey died in 2014. We had one in 2015 and one in 2016. And I was sitting at Paul's table and I said, people love Casey. And Paul agreed. He shook his head. He goes, people love Casey. And I think it's because of the love that he put out there, that even when you see him at his worst, people will defend him.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good assessment of it, I would say. And he yeah, he's and he you know, he projected the humanity. It always came forth. Now, I was curious to see if you had did you witness any more temper tantrums that weren't recorded and cemented in history?
Well, there's a medley of them on YouTube. And a lot of
Yeah.
them when he was doing promos. In fact, I was there for one of the promos that I thought was hilarious because he
Yeah.
goes, "Hey, this is Casey Kasem. Remember me to WCIX or whatever in Cincinnati at Saturday from 6 to 10 or whatever." And he had to read one that said, "From 2 a.m. to 6 p.m." And he went, "Two."
That's my favorite one, actually.
That's one of my favorites. It's one of my
Mine
favorites.
too.
Two, and I was, I was like trying not to laugh because, but Casey, after that, he talks to Matt Wilson. Can you ask Don if we have to be on a station that runs us at 2 o'clock in the morning? Because we got to do better than this. I mean, come on. You can repeat us at 2 o'clock in the morning, but you can't have the first air of the week that chart 2 o'clock in the morning. So
Yeah,
there's stuff
that's
like that.
pretty bad. It's true. Yeah. So you moved along as you mentioned earlier to Dick Clark's to working for Dick Clark, and you worked there until 2005, as you said. And did you have any memories of those years you wanted to share post American Top 40, just out of curiosity? Just
Well, I was shocked because I came from Casey, who was a perfectionist. If he had to read a 4 hour script, he would take 4 hours. Now, mind you, we weren't playing the full records, right? I mean, they used to actually play they actually did the whole thing live, as Pete Battistini told you. They used to play the whole thing and do the show in real time. But every time they made a mistake, they'd have to go all the way back to the start of the first hour or the last hour. So Dick Clark, ironically, was the one who in 1972 told him, you guys are crazy. Because he was a guest host for 1840. He goes, you guys are crazy. Have the voice track separate. Take the mistakes out, and then you add it to the records after the fact. So they soon followed him. They did that. So the only thing that the engineers would play when Casey was doing his story was they would play the beginning of the song so he would know how to match the tempo. So if you're the inspiration 14 seconds before Peter Cetera started singing, they would start the song 14 seconds before Casey was supposed to stop singing. And then they play the outro to match the outro, up tempo. And that's it. He didn't hear the whole record. But Casey would take 4 hours to read a 4 hour script. Dick Clark took 40 minutes.
That's incredible.
I remember my first script and, and he just went to it. Blah, 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 and he's looking at it cold. He didn't practice anything. He just came from another meeting. He came from a meeting about American Music Awards. He goes, okay, what are we doing? Okay, roll tape. The scripts are all there. He just starts reading. Hi, this is Dick Clark in the U.S. Music on the United Stations Radio Networks. Welcome to Countdown America. This week we're gonna, and if he made a mistake, then then we'd stop tape and he'd do another take. But Dick was always in a rush, so he didn't like to be stopped.
Of
So
course.
it was a total 180 experience. I had to really like, you write what you think is the best story. Like, oh my God, this is just a great story. This is so dramatic, or this is so funny, or whatever. And he would just go through it so fast, and I would say, "Well, can you pick it up from that point? Well, what did I say? Blah, blah, blah. What would you want me to say?" That he goes, "Nah, close enough." Very different They are very different, but I will say this. The last time I saw Dick Clark before his stroke was on his birthday. See, because Dick had a hang up. I think when you call someone the world's oldest living teenager, you make him very self-conscious about the way he looks.
Oh, yeah.
So, he disappeared for a couple of weeks when he had, some touch-ups to his face.
Yeah.
He had some help. And he would not come in to record his show anywhere close to his birthday because he didn't want to be in the office to have Stevie Wonder call and say, "Happy birthday, Dick," or have Gloria Estefan, whoever, call to
Yeah.
say, "Birthday." He didn't want to hear it. He didn't want to know that he was getting older.
Yeah.
But the number 29 was November 30. I forgot his birthday. November 29, November 30, 2004. He had to be in the office for some reason. That was a Tuesday when we had to record the show. So he's sitting in the booth. I walk into the booth and I have this maniacal smile on my face with my hand extended, like I want to shake his hand. I go, I'm just grinning my teeth, like really over exaggerating. And he goes, "Don't say it. Don't say it. I don't want to hear it." He's throwing up his hands and turning away from me. And I go, "I wasn't going to say anything. I just want to say, have a nice day." So he shakes my hand and he just gives me the warmest smile. And he goes, "Ah, get out of here. Get out of here." So, we shut the door. We do the show. And so he's saying goodbye to us. And so Dick, "Oh, here he comes. Here he comes." I go, "Have a great day." And he goes, "Oh, Jeff, get me out of here. You're crazy. You're crazy." And he laughs. Ha. And a few days later, he had a stroke. He had a stroke, and no one saw him for half a year. He would not come into the office. We only heard rumors about how bad it was. It was like, I think it was the summer of 2005 when he invited the VPs of each department to finally meet with him at his home office a few blocks away. The rest of us had to wait until December 31st of that year, when he finally made a return to Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve to see how he talked. And my radio show was canceled just before Thanksgiving because we had to get substitute hosts for Dick for like a year. And we kept going. We got Connie Wilson of Wilson Phillips. We got, what did we get? Mark Wallengren, who was the morning guy from Coast FM, the top station in Los Angeles. He did a great job, super nice guy. And he practiced his script. So when he read my script, he did it the way you're supposed to deliver the script. Emphasis on the right word and right pauses. But November was when the affiliates had to re-sign their contracts to carry the show for another year. And enough of them didn't want to take it without Dick Clark being there. And Dick Clark couldn't do radio. So they, "Well, we're going to finish up the year. You do your year-end show, and that'll be it." So I had to what? So I was already let go. December 16, 2005, my last day. 2 weeks later, I'm watching in Hawaii, back home for vacation. I'm watching New Year's Rockin' Eve to see Dick Clark, and my jaw dropped. And I went, "Oh my God, it's bad. It's bad. Oh my God," because he had to slur.
That had to be hard. Like you said, he was somebody who was always cautious of his, I mean, conscious, I'll get it out, conscious of his looks, like you said, because of what, the youngest teenager, oldest teenager thing, like you said. So yeah, that had to have been. I've thought about that many times. I thought that had to be a real tough blow for him to suffer. And he soldiered on, but as long as he could. But and you have to give him credit for that. But yeah, that had to have been just catastrophic, personally. So I guess the other thing I was gonna talk about before we rounded things off here, gonna talk about Casey and your Asian American activism that you've been that you have done for the Media Action Network for Asian Americans. That's important stuff. And I think it's commendable a commendable cause, and I was going to get you to tell the story about how Casey became involved in helping you with that.
Right. Well, I was also involved in the mid 80s on to, well, 84 to 93. I was involved with this redress and reparations movement. We're trying to get Congress to pass a bill that would give an apology to the 120,000 Japanese Americans who were put in concentration camps during World War II. They had not been accused of any crime other than they were of Japanese descent. And because of political pressures, economic pressures, they were put in 15 different concentration camps across the country for 3 years. And it's the greatest violation of civil rights in our history, because unfortunately it was legal to own slaves. I'm not going to say what we faced was worse than what African Americans would do. It was not. But so I was very much involved in that. And we're trying to find ways to get attention for the bill. And we're going to have a variety show. That was the idea. So, of course, they asked me, Guy, can you ask Casey if he can MC? And I'm like, but they would always be asking me to ask Casey to do something. And I didn't want to put him on the spot. But I will say this. He said, you know what? Let me check with Jean, his wife, second wife. Yeah, because I think we have something that day. And he had something he was going to do with the National Enquirer. He goes, you know what? Jean said, yours is more important, so let's do yours. And I was like, wow. And we never got the variety show together. But you know, the fact that he was willing to drop something else to do our cause, I was just like really flattered.
Yeah.
Another thing was February 1992, we just had the first Gulf War. And of course, people wanted me to get Casey Kasem. And so Don Bustani, he said, you know, tell Casey I'll help him with the speech. Don was such a great guy. He was the guy behind the scenes. Casey got all the credit, but Don was there to support Casey. And so he helped him write the speech. And it was profound for me to be able to introduce on a stage in front of almost 1,000 people, Casey Kasem. He was a keynote speaker. And he said, you know, they're not thinking about rounding up Arab Americans. He's Lebanese American. But I think it's because of the people in this room who fought so hard to pass the redress bill to make this country realize what it did to its own loyal citizens. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart for all people of color, la, 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 la. It was just a profound moment. And I remember Don Bustani coming up to me during intermission, and he goes, because every single speaker talked about the way Arab Americans were being looked at funny by the FBI. They're going to apartments and going, hey, you have any Arabs in your apartment? I mean, just like a witch hunt.
Yeah.
You know, with that kind of stuff. Like, just because you're Arab, somehow you had something to do with 9/11. You had something to do with the Gulf War, or you're a sympathizer, or whatever. And every single person, without being told to mention the Gulf War, mentioned it and said, we got to stand behind our Arab American brothers and sisters. We cannot allow this to happen. We cannot allow this to happen, what happened to us. And Don Bustani came running to me and to me. She goes, Guy, I am so impressed with the Japanese American community. We Arab Americans, we gotta get our act together. You guys have done this. And they formed committees after that, because they said, look, we've gone through this. Let us tell you what you're probably gonna go through. Let us tell you how we dealt with it. So it was great. They had this ongoing committee between the redress groups and Arab Americans. But so that was the start of Casey doing things for me. 1992, I formed my Media Action Network for Asian Americans group. It's an all-profit, non-profit, all-volunteer group. We formed it because we're sick and tired of seeing stereotypes of Asian Americans on the media.
Yes,
we felt
yes.
it needed to give pushback, because people were just, you know, Asian guys were just being nerds, being laughed at, being beaten up. They all knew Kung Fu, but the white guy knew Kung Fu better than them and used it to beat the crap out of them. And they went off into the sunset with the Asian woman.
Mm.
And Asian women were only paired with white guys. And Asian men were not paired romantically with anybody. So
right.
We said, we got to stop this. This is like hurting everyone's self-esteem. This is making every white guy come up to an Asian woman and say, I understand your culture. I understand how oppressed you are. And these stupid opening lines, like Kamsahamnida, whatever the hell they were saying. So that's how we formed it. So 1993, we had a nationwide protest against the movie Rising Sun. It starred Sean Connery and Wesley Snipes. It was based on Michael Crichton's best-selling novel about the Japanese infiltrating the US Congress and killing people for Japanese business interests. And Casey Kasem was there at the press conference. And he said, I hope you all join me. We're going to be at Westwood tonight for the protest. I'm going to be there with my good friend Guy Aoki. My good friend Guy Aoki.
Wow.
I mean, if you told me as a seventh grader back there in Hilo, Hawaii, that Casey Kasem would know who I was, that would have been amazing. But for him to come out and speak at different events on my behalf and protest marching around a theater with 100-something people in
Yeah.
Westwood, a rising sun, and then in 1996 marching with us again against a radio station that kept putting on skits where anytime there was an Asian American in the news, even if they spoke without an accent, all of their disc jockeys would do imitations of them doing a Japanese accent or Chinese accent. And I gave the tape to Casey, and he goes, Guy, this man is ignorant. We have to educate him. Because they started bad mouthing us because we're attacking them in the press about what they're doing. And the disc jockey said, Asian Americans haven't suffered. Are you kidding me? African Americans have suffered. What? Asian Americans have had it easy. What are you talking about? I sent a tape to Casey. He goes, he's ignorant. He doesn't know about World War II, about internment camps. He doesn't know about the riots. He doesn't know. He went on and on. And I said, well, we're having a protest on Saturday. Can you make it? I'll be there. And he was there before I was. That's the kind of man Casey Kasem was. He stood on principle. And as the disc jockey said, because he was furious, we got on TV, and the next Monday he was raking us over the coals. He goes, how can Casey Kasem, a member of my own union, AFTRA, protest me? He was furious, right? But Casey didn't care. Casey said, look, he didn't say in so many words, but what he was doing was saying, we have to make a better world. And when people do ignorant stuff like this, we got to put a stop to it. And that's why I love Casey Kasem.
Yeah,
He didn't have
just
to do that. He didn't have to do this, and he did.
a great human being. That's a real
Just a
testament to
great
him.
human being. He's a great
Yeah.
human being. There's no one
Yeah.
like him. No one does that. Everyone would kind of like put their finger in the air and see which way is the wind blowing. And gee, if I do this, how's that going to make me look? How is that going to, people would, like, I made a joke at the memorial. If people want to see my tribute to Casey Kasem, go on YouTube, write my name and Casey Kasem Memorial, and you see my tribute to him. And it talks about what he meant to me.
It's wonderful, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it tells you why he was such a great human being.
Yeah. So when was the last time you saw Casey before? I mean, he was getting, obviously his health took a turn for the worst in the late 2000s, I guess around 2009, and he finally decided to call it quits in July of 2009, I believe. And so I was just wondering when the last time was that you saw him before the end, unfortunate end.
It was July 12th, 2006. And I remember, the reason I remember is that my sister was visiting from Hawaii with her two children, and she wanted to meet Casey and she wanted to meet Dick Clark. So we sat in on a recording session for America's Top 20, which was a hot AC countdown show. He was no longer doing American Top 40, he was
Right,
doing
yes.
Top 20. Ryan Seacrest already took over. So we got to sit in on a session with him. So I got to see Casey. I didn't know that was the last time I was going to see him. Took pictures and. And then the next day, it's my sister's birthday, July 13th. That's why I remember the date. We got to see Dick Clark. And it was great for me because that was what, 7 months after he went back on New Year's Rockin' Eve. So I had not
Yeah.
seen or talked to Dick since the stroke. So this was
Yeah.
me being able to talk to Dick and see what happened. So
Right.
it was just so meaningful to hear from his own mouth what happened to him. And he said, I forget if it was the left arm or right arm. He says, my doctor said I'd never be able to lift my arm again. And he went, like,
Wow.
no big deal. Here I am. I'm lifting my arm.
Yeah.
But I remember I told him, I said, I don't know if you know this, Dick, but you know, a lot of times after people would leave Dick Clark Productions, they'd come and visit us, and they're working at other companies, and they would say, you don't know what it's like out there. It's cold. It's corporate. It's not like here. This is like a family atmosphere. And I said, thank you for giving us a place where we all felt that we belong, like we're all a family. And he just gave me the warmest smile. So I'm just glad I told
Oh yeah, that's fantastic.
him.
Yeah, it's yeah, well, this has certainly been a real pleasure to hear these stories. This has been fantastic for me, and I'm sure a lot of people listening will feel the same way, because it's you know, we know these people, but the personal stories help humanize them in a way that that you know, you otherwise wouldn't be able to do, and so your stories are what, you know, it keeps them alive. People that knew them, like yourself, who worked with them, and it's so just so meaningful to me. So I appreciate you taking some time to come on and talk about these things and these.
Yeah, it's going to be the 10th anniversary of Casey's passing in June. He died in Father's Day of 2014, and
Yeah,
Dick Clark died
2012, I
February,
believe. Yeah.
April 2012. Yeah, 2 years
Yeah.
before Casey. So, I just want to say, if people want to check out, I did do a video of Casey reading my Tony Burrows trivia. It's on YouTube. If you type in Tony Burrows, Burrows, King of the Lead Singers, I use footage that TV stations had taken of him in the studio recording America the 40. And I try to make his mouth sync up to the actual recording, and it came pretty close. But I also used, when he would play clips of the Tony Burrows hits, I went to videos of Tony singing it back in the
Yeah.
days. I think it'll be a lot of fun to see that, because he's my favorite male singer of all time. And I told him that when I interviewed him later on. So.
Wow, yeah, I'm quite a fan too. So I'm right there with you. Yeah, I will post links to those videos, actually. The
Okay.
your eulogy and Tony Burrows, your Tony Burrows thing. Those are really entertaining links that I think people will enjoy. So again, thank you so much for coming on and being a part of Adam's Corner. It's like I said, the pleasure is all mine, as it were.
Thank you. I was just going to say real fast that
Yeah.
Casey narrated one of two of my Mana documentaries. So if you look, Mana Story, MANAA, man plus two A's, Mana Story, Casey Kasem, you'll see he's narrating the video, and he's also, you can see him in the protests.
Yeah, I'll actually add a link to that too, because you did send that. So yes, I will make sure
Okay.
I'll put those up, and one stop shopping, as it were. People can go there and find all of them. And it's like I said, I highly urge people listening to check them out, because it will kind of give you an idea of a better idea of what we're speaking of here. So well, thanks again,
Thank you so
and.
much. I'm glad you care about the show, and we need to keep it going because it's still syndicated and it's on Sirius XM.
Yes, and I
And and,
listen.
and, and join the join the Facebook pages. We have several American Top 40 Facebook pages that you can join, and it's
Yes,
very,
those
very active.
are wonderful. Yes, I'm a member of all of them, as you can.